Hello, and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. All of Jonathan Knight's books have been about Cleveland sports. While those might seem to be of interest only to denizens of that city, his latest, The Making of Major League, a just-a-bit-inside look at the classic baseball comedy, is much more universal, appealing to fans not only of the local Indians, but of fans of baseball, fans of movies, and especially fans of baseball movies. I'm all in for anything that goes behind the scenes, so this book touches all the bases, as it were. I spoke with Jonathan Knight about what made Major League such a cinematic all-star. Jonathan Knight, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So, the late 80s seemed to be a golden age for baseball movies. You had The Natural, you had 8 Men Out, you had Field of Dreams, and you had Major League. Why do you think this happened at that particular moment?
I think, and that's such an interesting time period, particularly those last few that you mentioned, Bull Durham, Field of Dreams, and Major League all came out basically within 10 months of each other, or within a calendar year, essentially. Bull Durham was sort of at the vanguard of that, leading the way, and 8 Men Out as well, and that one sort of gets overlooked because it did sort of struggle at the box office, but critically, and even today, holds up as a great baseball movie. But you're right, it is really an interesting time, and it is really fascinating in a way that so many iconic baseball movies or movies of any genre came out just slap bang all together like that, and really on a palate load. And I think the big reason why that happened was because it was long overdue. I think that aside from The Natural, which came out in 1984, about 4 or 5 years before that, and really was sort of the iconic baseball movie, if not sports movie, of the decade, you have to go back to really The Bad News Bears in 1976 to see a successful baseball movie, either box office or critically, and that's part of the reason why Major League took, number one, took so long to get made, and number two, then eventually did make it to the big screen, was that Hollywood was just not making baseball movies. There was just a long dry spell where they just did not see it commercially viable. They did not think that people wanted to go see baseball movies, and I think that you reached a sort of a tipping point where a lot of good ideas kind of came to Hollywood at the same time and sort of went into production around the same time, and everyone just thought, well, okay, it's been a long drought, let's take a chance with this one and this one and this one, sort of all at the same time. And then by the time they all came out, then of course you saw in the next 5 or 6 years, you just saw an avalanche of baseball movies, several of them not particularly good, following or riding that wave. So yeah, it really was. 1988, 1989 really was, in some ways, a high watermark in the history of baseball films.
Now, what is it that made the Indians the perfect team for this film? Do you think a movie like this could have been made with any other team, like the Marlins or the Rays? Or what was unique about the Indians that made it so successful?
No, that's part of what makes Major League so unique. And honestly, what I think has made it so successful is that it wasn't like most of the baseball movies, or really most of the sports movies that came out either before or after that, where you sort of write a script and then just insert team here. Like, it really could be any team, whether it's fictional or even if it's nonfiction, you just figure, well, okay, just in this case, you have the story of this team that's sort of struggling. Could have been anybody. It could have been the Cubs. It could have been the Red Sox. There could have been any number of teams that you could have sort of shoehorned into this story. But that's really why it's unique, is that David Ward, who wrote and eventually directed this movie, always intended this to be about the Indians. Like, to him, this story had to be the Indians. It was built into the DNA of the story. I mean, to the point where you look at A League of Their Own and think, well, okay, I really like this story, but can we change it so it's about guys? Like, no, you can't do that. I mean, that's the point of the movie, and that's how David Ward saw Major League. It really doesn't work if it's not the Indians. You can't just interchange it, or, as he was afraid might happen, that Major League Baseball would require that he not use a real team, that it be sort of a fictional team that made up, similar to what we saw in The Natural with the New York Knights. So, yeah, I think that's part of what made Major League work, is that it was really built sort of ground in reality and had that Indians backstory sort of built into the DNA of the script.
Now, you mentioned the input of Major League Baseball in this, and that's something I've always wondered about in reading fiction. You know, what kind of permissions do you have to get from Major League if you use the name of a real team? Troy Seuss has a series of baseball historical mysteries in which he has his fictional player on real life teams,
right,
of those years, and I'm wondering what Major League Baseball has to do with it. Is there a fee involved for using a real name? Do you have to get permission from the team? You know, how does that work?
And it is different, I think, in books than in movies. I'd be interested to see what Troy Seuss has gone through in his books and what sort of hoops he's had to jump through. But in movies, and even in movies, it's very different now than it was back in 1988 when Major League went into production. Back then, again, because it had been so long and it had been such a dry spell since any Major League, actual Major League teams are sort of depicted in a movie, that Major League Baseball was much more conducive and thinking, well, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, why not? That's cool. We can be in a movie. Yeah, you know, there's much more of a clubhouse mentality about it, to the point that it was very sort of informal. Even the permission request itself was sort of informal, and it's just, you sort of just sent off a letter to Major League Baseball's offices, and they had to approve the script. They had to see the script, of course, but the script basically just got tossed around the office. It actually wound up on the desk of Commissioner Peter Ueberroth at the time, actually reviewed the script and made some notes. That's how informal this was, and how very different that is today. Today, there's an entire division of Major League Baseball that deals with all this stuff, both in film and television, and they have much more control and are much more specific in providing feedback and what you can and can't say and do with a script, and they are viewing dailies every single day. So there's much more corporate control now over how Major League Baseball is portrayed in film and television, and presumably books. I would think that would carry over into books as well, but very different now than it was back in the 80s.
Now, you mentioned several times in the book the language of the locker room, and how it's used in the book, and how a lot of people couldn't bring their kids because of the film's rating. And you also talked just now about how Ueberroth and Major League Baseball had to approve the script. It's kind of surprising that they would give it a pass with all that language in it.
It really is. There's a lot of things really in that script that would never get approved today. I mean, even maybe 10 years later, it wouldn't have gotten approved for any number of reasons. But it is sort of surprising. And again, I think it's because it was very much a buyer's market for the people making Major League. They really sort of had that to their advantage, that this was very unique for Major League Baseball, and they were much more conducive to this. But yeah, when you look at it today, in hindsight, you think, wow, I can't believe that they would allow that much language, that they would allow, to say nothing of the basic premise of the movie, of a Major League, the owner of a Major League team threatening and planning to move her team and deliberately fielding a bad team in order to move it. That would never get approved today. So there's a lot of things you look at and say, wow, yeah, this was very much a movie of its time. And again, that's another reason why I think it really does resonate all these years later, is because there is that sincerity. There is that sense of genuine reality that's in it, that this wasn't, there wasn't an antiseptic sort of cleanse done at the corporate level to make this thing appealing to all audiences. It was just very honest, and for that reason, it has stood the test of time.
Now, the book is broken down into basically a chronological order. Talk a little bit about the pre-production that goes on, because I don't think most people have a sense of all the planning and prep work that has to be done.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, how much work goes in long before cameras ever roll. And really does even continue while cameras are rolling, because even when you're filming one day here, you've still got people preparing for tomorrow over there. So, I mean, it really is something that goes on throughout. But the pre-production, once you finally get to the point where you're green light, you have your budget, you have your casting is done, all of that, and that in itself sometimes takes years, as it did with Major League. But pre-production, once you're set and you know you have a schedule and all of that is set, then you're getting into location scouting and extras casting. I mean, it is a massive amount of work, and particularly for a movie like this where you do have, you're casting dozens of extras, as both as ball players, in some cases as fans that appear in the ballpark or that appear in a restaurant scene or what have you, and then wrangling the locations. In this case, most of Major League was shot in and around Milwaukee, primarily at County Stadium, but also in several locations out around the ballpark, out in neighborhoods of Milwaukee, various parts of Milwaukee. But everything that you see, every scene that is shot on location, was scouted and carefully planned and coordinated and approved, and discussions were had, meetings were held, and all of this. So, I mean, it really is, it is mind-boggling, really, for the common person to really kind of try to contemplate how much work, how much planning goes into a movie. For us, it's, you know, we drop $7, we walk in the theater, and for the next 100 minutes, we enjoy this thing and move on. For a movie production, it's, you know, that's why it takes a year, 2 years, multiple years in many cases to make a movie, for these little tiny details that most people really don't even pay attention to.
And the shooting is done out of sequence. And you talk about some of the difficulties of that, you know, coming back to something, you know, days later for something that actually precedes it in the picture, and the difficulties of continuity and making sure that everything matches up.
Right, and that's something that comes up a lot with most movies. Most movies are not shot entirely in sequence for any number of reasons. And in this case, in the case of Major League, you had a very large departure that you even don't see in Hollywood very much in any type of movie, in that because of basically the logistics and what they needed from Milwaukee and from County Stadium, they basically had to shoot the end of the movie right away. In basically week two of a 10-week shoot, they had to shoot the end of a movie, which everyone was a little nervous about, because While actors are pros, and they obviously don't need to shoot a movie in sequence to understand what's going to happen next or how they should be reacting in this scene compared to how they react in a later scene or a previous scene, at the same time, you still would like the actors to have some time to kind of figure out their character and figure out how they're playing with other actors in certain scenes and what have you, and really get a feel for it, so you're at least shooting for a couple of weeks before you head into the most important part of the movie that the story sort of hinges on. But because the key to the whole thing of shooting in Milwaukee was they really needed a couple of nights of getting big crowds out to County Stadium to shoot the playoff game, to get several of the key shots of the team taking the field and Charlie Sheen coming out of the bullpen, several shots like that of clearly having thousands and thousands of people in the stands. And the strategic decision was made, and turned out to be the correct one, that if we're going to be a big deal coming to Milwaukee, Milwaukee hadn't had a Hollywood movie shot there in 20 years, this was big news, we need to take advantage of that and leverage that into getting a big crowd. And the best way to do that is to do it right away before word gets out and before the bloom comes off the rose a little bit and people realize that watching a movie get made is like watching grass grow. So, and they made the decision, let's do this right away. So the very first weekend they were in Milwaukee on a Friday and Saturday night, they wound up getting 20,000 people out to the ballpark on consecutive nights, and it worked brilliantly. I mean, it worked, I think, better than they even anticipated that it would, and whatever cost it cost the production to, or not even the production, but just in terms of the actors getting to know their characters and that, everybody hit the ground running and it worked out fine. There turned out to be no real downside to it, and it worked out brilliantly.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the casting here. You have Charlie Sheen as Wild Thing. He had been in 8 Men Out as one of the 8 Men Out. He's obviously a very good athlete. Dennis Haysbert played a baseball player in Japan in Mr. Baseball. I don't know, was he good? He must have enjoyed doing the baseball scenes if he didn't know the movie about it, unless, you know, a job is a job. Some of the other players, Wesley Snipes, you're right, did not have any baseball experience, and then that proved to be a problem and a challenge from time to time. And Tom Berenger, too. And him, I found actually the least believable of all of them because of his age, The fact that mid-30s ball player with bad knees was batting second in the lineup, I found a little hard to believe. But were any of the actors injured enough to film, to delay the filming at any point, since they're not
out? No, right, and that was something they were very conscious of as they were casting and then even preparing for the film, is they really wanted to make sure, number one, that the actors that they were casting in these roles as the key players, that they had at least some baseball experience, that they weren't going to be trotting out a half a dozen guys who had no idea how baseball was played, had never played it before, and as we've seen in some other movies, that shines through. You really can't cover that up through the magic of filmmaking. So they were very cautious of that, and really, as you said, other than Wesley Snipes, who, the upside for Wesley Snipes was he was and is a fantastic athlete and had a lot of experience in dance and in fencing and other aspects of theater that he was able to make it believable and was able to pick things up and learn them very quickly. Other than Wesley Snipes, all of the other actors who played the primary players had at least some experience playing baseball. Some of them it was just Little League, but at least there was that foundation and that seed there that they did know what they were doing and could pull it off. And then in the case of Charlie Sheen, I think the best example, he looks like a player. I mean, of that group, I think he's the one who is the most realistic, particularly when you hold his performance up as a ball player to, say, Tim Robbins in Bull Durham. I mean, I love Tim Robbins, and that's a great movie, and he does a fine job in that movie. But when he's on the mound throwing, I just don't buy him as the number one prospect in anybody's farm system. Whereas Charlie Sheen, you do buy it. I mean, as much as you need to buy it for the movie, you do, and you have that verisimilitude there. The other thing they did was bringing in Steve Yeager as a technical consultant was his official title, but really he was the coach, and he put the guys through a boot camp before filming even began, and part of that was to, again, hone their skills, but also to prevent some of those injuries that can lay guys up. If you get a hamstring pull in the middle of shooting, or you sprain an ankle or something, and now you can't take the field, you can't run, you can't do certain things for a week, that's going to mess up your schedule. So they really wanted to make sure that wasn't going to happen, and Yeager did a great job of putting the guys through their paces and getting them in shape and making sure that wasn't going to be a problem, and it wasn't. I mean, guys, obviously, at the same time, guys were dinged up. I mean, particularly, you look at Behringer's, you look at and Charlie Sheen throwing 150 pitches every 4 days. I mean, the guys were sore, the guys were dinged up. Wesley Snipes has strawberries, raspberries all over his knees and hips, and, you know, the guys were dinged up by the time it was over, but nothing to the point that they just couldn't perform. So it really did work out. Again, a minefield full of problems there to have to address, but they did, and it comes off really well.
And, of course, you have Bob Uecker.
Yes. What else is there to say? I mean, Bob Uecker is really one of the more memorable parts of that movie, and I don't know that it was intended to be. I don't know that Harry Doyle was as big a character as Bob Uecker made him, and that's a testament to Bob Uecker and what a fantastic character in the truest sense of the word that Bob Uecker is. I mean, just a genuinely funny guy. And was able to bring so much to the movie and to that character, more so than I think David Ward ever imagined when he wrote that character.
And I can't think of another regular professional actor who could have done what Uecker did with the role. Now, Uecker he's been on television many times as a guest on talk shows where he was very funny. He was on Mr. Belvedere where he was decent, but you couldn't classify him as an actor as the others were.
No, and that's a great point in that, one, that he did such a nice job. You know, there's so many people who are funny and charismatic and energetic and all of these good things when just in conversation or even on radio or whatever, but it's something else when you got lights, camera, action. It's much more difficult to do. And he, number one, was able to do that. I mean, and very, very well. And I think part of that reason is that, in a way, more so than any other role or any other TV or commercial appearance that he ever had made before, he was really tuned into this character in that basically this character was him in many ways, or that he turned this character into him in ways that I think he really understood Harry Doyle and how he worked even more so than David Ward did. So there'd be a lot of lines that he would basically ad-lib. He'd get a sense, he had to film his scenes in 2 days. This is filmed during baseball season, of course, and Uecker then, as now, was the broadcaster, real-life broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers. So he had a very limited time, limited schedule in which he could do this. Tony only was able to shoot all of his scenes in 2 days. So he very quickly, in these two long sessions, would sit at the booth in his actual workspace at County Stadium, where he'd always sit, and he would have the script in his hands, and he would look at the scene they were doing and read it and kind of get a sense of it. It wasn't really memorizing things, just get a sense of what's going on in the scene, throw the script down at his feet, pull up to the mic, and basically go and just sort of ad-lib his way through his understanding of the scene and drop in some lines and things, something that he actually had said or had thought of saying on actual air for Brewers games, and inserted them into the movie. And so there's lots of things that actually they couldn't use that are just hysterical, that for whatever reason they didn't quite fit, or maybe a little too much, or even for Harry Doyle to say. There was just great, great stuff that Uecker was able to bring to that part, and maybe the most memorable part of the movie. I don't know. For a lot of people, certainly I think he's the most quotable character after all these years. We've got a talking bobblehead of him now, of course. So, yeah, I mean, Bob Uecker is just a gem, just truly priceless in what he was able to bring to Major League.
Because certainly you've had professional broadcasters even who, when put into movies, you know, do not come across anywhere playing themselves. They're playing themselves, and they're extremely wooden, and
yeah,
it just doesn't make for an enjoyable, makes for a cringeworthy performance in many cases. You spoke about one of the main plots of the movie is the owner wants them to lose so she can relocate them to a better situation. And you talk about that as a moneyball aspect, and I'm wondering if you could describe that a little bit.
Sure, and that really only comes out in the original ending of the movie. You don't really get that in the ending that we have or the ending that we know. The original ending of the movie was actually a twist. There, we were going to find out right before the final playoff game that the Indians played that Rachel Phelps never actually intended to move the team, that her plan all along was, basically, this was a one-year chance. She knew that the team was broke. She inherited a team that was in terrible financial straits and had 1 year to try and turn this around. And much like Billy Beane in Oakland and other situations that have followed, had no money to go out and try and get talented players, and really had nothing in the farm system or anything, any kind of assets to leverage. So the only thing she could do was to find these sort of cast-offs and sort of these players that had these intangible qualities that other teams had overlooked or disregarded, and put together a team that would be the winning team that the Indians had been searching for years. So she, in a way, was very brilliant, and it was a smart twist that obviously didn't work. Test audiences hated that, primarily because Margaret Whitten, the actress, did such a fantastic job of making her such a great villain. They didn't want to just have this scene where Hannibal Lecter walks in at the end of Silence of the Lambs. Just kidding. I really am not a serial killer. It's all a ruse. You know, so people obviously didn't like that. So for the good of the movie, and I think even today we can look at saying, yeah, that was the right decision. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that was sort of an interesting twist and really the beginning of Moneyball. We had no idea in 1984 when David Ward was writing this. He was really almost 20 years ahead of the game, ahead of the curve, and sort of seeing this sort of very... a very unique, sort of bizarre way of looking at baseball that no one would have thought of at the time.
I'm wondering, though, if you went back and then looked at many of the baseball movies, even of the 40s and 50s, you're looking at a ragtag group of bums who no one expects to succeed, and what do you know? They succeed. So, I mean, if you want to take that Moneyball as an example, you can pretty much backtrack it, like, to the middle of the century.
You could, and that's become such a trope, and even then it was a trope, and especially now that I think that twist ending did try to avoid, in that, oh, well, it's this ragtag group, whether it's the Bad News Bears, whatever it is, it's this ragtag group that's underdogs and aren't expected to be good and really aren't that good, but they suddenly get motivated by whatever, or there's some X factor that motivates them to win, whatever it may be, which, you know, whatever, it's serviceable for a sports movie, but I think that was one of the main benefits of this twist, is to say, you know, this didn't happen just by accident. It's sort of a response to several of these movies that where they just decide we really can win, so let's just win. And we know in real life it doesn't really work like that, that they just don't have enough motivation, and that's all it requires to win. That this was actually a long-term plan, that this was all orchestrated and this went the way that it's supposed to. So there are obviously problems that arise with that original ending, but the good side is that, you know, hey, that's a different way of looking at it. And when you look at all of these other movies, particularly the ones that followed Major League, that basically just follow that same trope, it's kind of a refreshing way to look at it, that it wasn't just they flipped on a light switch and started to win. No, this was part of a master plan that began to kick in right on schedule.
And I'm going to get you out of here on one last question. Do I hear this talk of a reboot for Major League?
Well, there is a script that has been written for depending on how you look at it, a third sequel or a second sequel. Most people disavow the Back to the Minor sequel, the Major League 3, if you will. It really had nothing to, David Ward had nothing to do with it, did not write it, did not direct it, it didn't even have anything to do with the Indians, it did not have Charlie Sheen, Tom Berenger. So many people disavow that third one. So I think particularly because that third one was such a dud, and even the second one sort of left a bad taste in many people's mouths, there was always this sort of feeling that David Ward and some of the other people that were involved in the original kind of wanted to go back and end this sort of story on the right note and end this series on the right note. And so a few years ago, he wrote a script for a new sequel, a Major League 3 or 4, whatever you want to call it, that would take place in the modern day and would bring back many of the same characters in very different roles at this point now. And they've been trying for a couple of years now. They've been trying very, very hard to get it done, but there's several different financial obstacles that have kind of emerged that they have to deal with and jump all kinds of Hollywood insight that goes into this and backstory. But yeah, I mean, the idea is still that they want to make this movie and at some point to bring the band back together and make one more Major League and sort of, like I said, close it out on a good note. So whether or not it ever sees the light of day, I hope it does. I've read the script. It's really brilliant. It would be a perfect ending to this story. Whether or not it ever sees the light of day, I think at some point, whether it's this movie or, as you originally mentioned it, a reboot, since there's very little left from the 1980s that hasn't been rebooted, I think at some point we will see some reincarnation of Major League in theaters.
And we've been talking with Jonathan Knight, author of The Making of Major League, a just a bit inside look at the classic baseball comedy published by Gray & Company. Jonathan, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, you bet. My pleasure.
And that was the Baseball Bookshelf Conversation with Jonathan Knight. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next time when our guest will be Dick Flavin, poet laureate for the Boston Red Sox, as well as their PA announcer. He'll be discussing his new book, Red Sox Rhymes, Verses and Curses. In the meantime, please stop by Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on the national pastime. And remember, if you have a question or suggestion, please don't hesitate. Email me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. So long, everybody.
Sat in the stands, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand. He'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a